Good. Whoa. Excuse me there. Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. It is Tuesday, May 19th, 2026. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Before we get started with today's episode, I just want to acknowledge that this program, as well as all of our programs here at CJSF, are broadcasted on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hulkamilam and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here on these lands since time immemorial. Now we have a hour-long episode of a lot of talk from across the province of BC, some pieces that I produce, as well as others from other fellow LJI journalists and other community stations across the province. So much amazing journalism being produced by everyone involved with the local journalism initiative. But before we get into any of that, let's start off with some local music. This is some glambient, for lack of a better term. And I don't think there is a better term other than glambient for this. This one is from the Golden Age of Wrestling, and it is titled Friendship Cove. This is off their latest album, Sweet Chin Music. We'll be right back. WBC. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Local Government Awareness Week in BC took place from May 10th to 16th, with the goal of generating awareness and educating the public about the roles and responsibilities of local government. Throughout the month of May, the city of Burnaby has been hosting informational sessions on the upcoming municipal election in October. Titled Your City, Your Choice, An Introduction to Burnaby's 2026 General Local Election, these events were hosted by the city's election team, serving as an interactive session on voting, the positions Burnaby residents will be voting for, and how and why to get involved. CJSF reached out to Burnaby's election team for more information on these events and found out that the audience turnout had been less than expected. In hindsight, they said it may have been too early to host info sessions 6 months before the election. However, it's never a bad time to learn more about how to be involved with municipal elections, so CJSF sat down for an interview with Deputy Chief Election Officer Josh Comia and Chief Election Officer Dennis Back. During the conversation, we spoke about some of the main takeaways from the info sessions, from how to vote come October 17th, all the way to becoming a candidate yourself in the municipal election. Please take a listen to our conversation. The first question I wanted to ask, because the main thing I wanted to learn about were these events that you were hosting throughout Burnaby, specifically throughout the Burnaby Library System. What were these events? How did they come to be?
Well, it's all part of a community outreach, and it's just the effort that we make to go out into the community and create an awareness around the election, answer questions. We're there to provide information to voters, to potential candidates, somebody that maybe is just toying with the idea of running for office. So what would I have to do? How do I file nomination papers? So we go out there and make ourselves available. On reflection, we may have started a bit early because the turnout has been low. We may look at perhaps repeating that as we get closer to the election, but that's the purpose of it. But that community outreach takes a variety of different forms. There's also coming up on June 6th, there's the Burnaby Hats Off Day on Hastings Street, pretty big community event. We will have a presence there. On August 30th, there's something called Car Free Day that attracts a lot of people. We'll have a presence there. So it's just being there, handing out rack cards, which provide information about the election, again, awareness and Q&A.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting that part of these events, too, also included information on how to participate as someone running for a position for the city. Can you I guess explain that a bit more, like what goes into that and like what I guess prompted you to include that as part of the presentation?
Well, people that are considering running for election, they can go to the website, but we're just there to provide information to everybody. And if somebody, like, say for example, you, Danny, if you're interested in running for office, what would I need to do? Well, the nomination period is September 1st to 11th, and you have to fill out nomination papers and file them only between those dates. And so it's just part of the whole election process. It's just another piece. There's voters, there's candidates, so forth.
Is part of also putting together these events aiming to increase retention as well and I guess participation in the election? I know that throughout the board, municipal elections in the Lower Mainland do sometimes struggle when it comes to voter turnout. And I'm wondering if that was something that you had considered as well.
Oh, no, that thank you for a very good question. That's something that we all municipalities struggle with is voter apathy. And, absolutely, that's the underlying principle or the fundamental reason why we do community outreach, why we do advertising, and all of our efforts are to try and increase voter turnout. And at the end of the day, it's up to the individual whether they want to come out and vote or not, but We, first of all, it's an awareness. So make sure that they know that the election's taking place and provide information and just try and generate a little bit more interest. But a lot of that, too, takes place on the part of the candidates. And that's why candidates do as much advertising as they do. And they're trying to draw attention to their own candidacy. But on a higher level, as the election, as the staff that are organizing the election, we have to do our part on a broader level to make sure that people are aware of the election and what their opportunities are. I mean, voting opportunities.
For sure. And yeah, speaking of voting opportunities, I was wondering if you would be able to, you know, for those who weren't able to attend one of these events, explain, I guess, what sort of voting opportunities you detailed in these presentations.
It's a bit of a recap here. So the general voting day is October 17th. And all voting days, it's 8 in the morning till 8 at night. So on general voting day, there are 33 locations. Preceding that is what's called advance voting. So if for any reason that you feel that you either are not going to be available on general voting day, or you just prefer to vote early and avoid lineups perhaps, then there are advance voting opportunities on October 3rd, 7th, and 10th at 6 different locations, which will be well advertising on our website and otherwise. In addition to that, another voting opportunity and something that really just started through legislative change in 2022 is something called mail ballot voting. So let's just say, for example, it would suit the person best that is saying, you know what, I'm going on vacation, I'm going south for holidays or going somewhere, I will vote by mail. So there's an opportunity after August 31st to apply for a mail voting package. And assuming that you provide all the information required, including identification, we will mail you a mail voting package. You complete that and return that to us. So that's another opportunity for people to vote that are not able to be here in person and vote on the other ways. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the overview of the various ways in which you can vote.
Can you also go into what people are voting for in particular?
Well, that's what the nomination process is about. Just reaching back in 2022, there was no mayoral race. The Mayor Hurley was acclaimed and unchallenged. But, you know, the more likely scenario is that people will be voting for a mayor. They'll be voting for 8 council positions and also for 7 school trustee positions.
Okay. I think those were the main questions I wanted to ask just regarding what these events are. But is there anything that we haven't discussed throughout this conversation that you think people should know about?
Well, nothing that particularly comes to mind. But, you know, I also just offer you the... make sure that you know that our door is open and you're welcome to talk to us at any time if you've got any follow-up questions or you want to check back with us.
Once again, that was our conversation with Deputy Chief Election Officer Josh Comia and Chief Election Officer Dennis Back about the upcoming municipal election in Burnaby on October 17th and a series of info sessions that the election team had been hosting titled Your City, Your Choice, an introduction to Burnaby's 2026 general local election. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This interview would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. And we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you all so much for tuning into that piece. You know, we are a bit of a ways away for the next municipal election, not just in Burnaby, but in New West, in Vancouver, in North Vancouver, in the city of North Vancouver, in Langley, in Langley 10. You know, there's a lot of municipalities that are going to be hosting elections. And, you know, it's just important to know what you're voting for, how to vote, and also that you should vote. you know, that's also an important thing that I think we touched on a bit in that interview, is just the constant struggle and fight to get people to vote during municipal elections, because they are very consequential to your daily life. Yeah. Anyways, we're going to be moving on to a piece farther up north. This comes from CIFR Radio in Prince George, and it is about spring dips, zombie fires, and the 2026 fire season outlook for the Prince George Fire Center, which obviously this is central to Prince George, but I think is relevant to all of us this upcoming summer. Take a listen.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFR Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Regionally, in the Prince George Fire Center, the largest of six fire centers in the province, covering roughly 36 million hectares or 336,000 square kilometers from the Yukon border down to almost Quesnel, but including an expanse stretching over to include Vail Mount to the east, that fire center, ours specifically, not talking about the rest of BC, had a good snowpack this winter. That winter precipitation has been followed by abnormally high spring season temperatures, though. We're good, though, right? We're not in danger of big forest fires flaring up right now, right? Right? Maybe not. We have to first factor in something called the spring dip, whatever that is. Then, holdover fires, the zombie fires that are somehow still burning from last year. And, looking ahead, we've got to realize to what extent BC Wildfire Services can even predict what kind of fire season we'll have. Carly DeRosier, a BC Wildfire Services information officer, connected with us to break it down. Thank you so much for joining us over the line today, Carly.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's already a hot spring, and one thing leads to another. It becomes a dry spring, and reading information coming from the BC Wildfire Service, that is my impression. Are we looking at a dry spring right now in the Prince George Fire Center?
Yeah, certainly. So, of course, in the past couple of weeks, we've seen above seasonal temperatures for this time of year. So across almost the whole province, we are seeing temperatures about 8 to 10 degrees hotter than what we would expect. Fortunately, we are seeing a downturn in weather later this week. But that hot, dry weather early on in the season has certainly exacerbated the dry conditions that we were already experiencing. Fortunately, in many regions of the Prince George Fire Center, we got a lot of precipitation last fall. So there was more moisture in the ground in the fall than we had seen in the previous couple of years. So we're kind of starting the year off in a better place. Certainly, we're still in these drought conditions, but not as severe of a drought. We're not seeing this the severity of drought that we saw in the spring of 2025 and 2024. So kind of some good news, but also at the same time, with these elevated temperatures, things are drying out really fast as well.
When it comes to springtime, there is a period that's referred to as the spring dip. We had a lot of snow. That snowpack helped quite a bit, and I would imagine it lengthens the amount of time we have in this spring dip. But the spring dip is something that happens every year. But what is that? Can you tell us a little bit about this concept?
What spring dip refers to is the period of time between when the snow melts and when the forest fuels, trees, shrubs, those kinds of things, once they absorb the moisture from the ground and their leaves and needles are then kind of full of moisture again. So it's the period of time when they're still dormant from the winter and they haven't absorbed the moisture in the ground to replenish and make the leaves and needles more resistant to wildfire. So it's generally this period. It really depends where you are in the province is the biggest determining factor of when we will see these spring dip conditions. Currently, we are seeing that in many areas of the Prince George Fire Center. So the needles on the trees are really low in moisture content, and that makes them very receptive to ignition. So it's this period of time in the spring where the fuels haven't absorbed that moisture. And even though we do see generally cooler temperatures in the spring, there is still this period of heightened risk of wildfire until those forest fuels have absorbed that moisture from the ground. However, as we talked a bit about the drought, that can also kind of add additional complexity, is as these fuels kind of wake up and go to absorb the moisture, if there's no moisture in the ground for it to absorb, then we don't necessarily see that rebound in those conditions, which is kind of what we've seen in the past couple of years, where we would expect there to be a period of time following spring dip where there is less likelihood of ignition. We haven't seen that reprieve as much. Fortunately, this year with more moisture in the ground, hopefully we see less vulnerability to fire, but we are still in the drought conditions. Even though the drought's not as severe, there's just not as much moisture for those fuels to pull from the ground. So it's possible that they won't necessarily be as resilient as they would otherwise be.
You've already explained this to some extent, but I'm curious about some of the factors that lead to fire bans in, you know, various districts, but ours anyway. We have Category 3 and Category 2 bans. Category 1 is still open, so you can have a small contained campfire. But you described a bunch of information that goes into determining risk, but how do you gather the information to determine the risk of fire, that kind of thing? Are you coring trees to figure out how much moisture content is in there? How do you figure out if a bough of needles is ready to go or not on a more scientific side of things?
Yeah, so there is this period of spring dip affects more or is more relevant to like trees, whereas I guess the other factor being the grasses as well. So they're still in the same situation where they haven't greened up from the winter. So we generally in the spring, in addition to the low moisture content in the needles and the leaves, we also see a similar condition in the grasses as well, where the dead grass from the winter hasn't revived yet. So we often have almost like 100% grass curing. So in the spring, in this period of greater risk, that's more so when we see those grass fires, because we generally have more moisture underneath. But that top layer, the grasses and the really fine fuels like twigs and shrubs, they can be still very receptive. So that is one factor that is considered when implementing the prohibitions, is even though there might not be a drought, or we might have had some rain that has been able to kind of penetrate the ground and replenish that moisture, there still can be a pretty severe risk of grass fire. And those are the ones that we see in the spring that can ignite easily, and they also generally spread very quickly. They're not kind of digging deep, and they're not as difficult to suppress, but it doesn't really take much wind at all for a grass fire to spread across the landscape. So when there is a really high risk of grass fire, and that is compounded by those drought conditions or the deeper dryness, those are certainly factors that do play into those prohibitions that are in place. And of course, we understand that yard cleanup, backyard cleanup, all those things, there are ways that people do kind of reduce their vulnerability and risk of wildfire. So those prohibitions are not implemented lightly. There's a lot that goes into it, but there is kind of a period where the risk just becomes too severe. And then it is kind of like we have to eliminate that potential for human caused wildfires when the risk does become too high.
One of the factors that also is happening of increasing frequency over the years, it seems, as we've had larger fires, is this concept of holdover fires. Colloquially, we refer to them as zombie fires, the fires that do not seem to die. Mm-hmm. We have a cold winter with lots of snow like we had recently, mm-hmm. but then these fires reemerge, and it just so happens that one of these has popped up in the Prince George Fire Center. For reference, that was on Friday, May 8th, that this hot spot was reported. That wildfire, though listed as out of control, has not grown over 1 hectare in size yet.
Yeah, there's a number of fires that have kind of popped up repeatedly in the past couple of years. So there are a number of things that kind of do play into that as well. In that area of the province, that kind of surface organic layer can be very, very deep, whereas in the southern regions of the province, it could be maybe a couple centimeters where we're down to the mineral soil, whereas up in the Fort Nelson zone, it can be multiple feet of kind of peat and bog. And with the lack of moisture in the muskeg, due to the drought over the past couple of years. We're seeing those fires burn really, really deep. That does require kind of crews to dig all the way to essentially where that fire is burning, whether it be in the root systems or just smoldering down below. And they are burning so deep that even when we get the snow, it can also almost provide like an insulation effect. And if we go into the winter and see a really rapid transition from summer conditions straight into winter conditions without that period of time where we get the precipitation in the form of rain that has the opportunity to kind of seep into the ground, if we do see that quicker transition where the ground does freeze very quickly after those much higher temperatures, then even if we get snow, it just doesn't have the ability to really seep in and extinguish the burning. So there's a couple things there. If we're not getting the precip, but if we are, is it even able to like really penetrate the ground? Fortunately, with the amount of rain that we got in the fall, we are seeing higher moisture levels in that region. But again, with just how deep it's burning and how persistent and how severe the drought conditions were, it's going to take quite a bit of rain over a prolonged period of time to completely eliminate that drought. So fortunately, with the additional moisture and the higher than normal rain, it's possible that we will see less prevalence of those overwintering fires pop up, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to completely eliminate the prevalence or the likelihood of them making themselves known. So there are a couple things that we do about those overwintering fires. Technology-wise, we use satellite technology to identify heat. And that's how this fire in the Fort Nelson zone was identified last week. There was a hot spot identified on the satellite. From there, once those are identified, crews will go out and then to get a visual confirmation that that is in fact an active fire, and then it'll be assigned a fire number. So that's what led it to pop up on the map. We're also come potentially as early as Wednesday, but kind of dependent on conditions. We will be doing some high level scanning. So that's where an aircraft, in this case a fixed-wing airplane, will fly over the zone, and they have the infrared technology as well to identify any heat. If they do identify areas of heat, then again, crews will go out and check it out just to validate that data. So a couple things that we're doing just to make sure that we are aware of and have eyes on those overwintering fires as early as possible and are able to manage them. But again, we did get a decent amount of precip in the fall, but that's not necessarily enough to completely eliminate the challenge. So it's possible and it's likely that we could see some more pop up as the snow does continue to melt. There are certain areas in that region that are still covered in snow, but much less snow even in the matter of about a week or so. So the less snow and the hotter temperatures, then we'll likely see kind of maybe more of this.
Is there a way to detect these hot spots in the winter seasons through satellite imagery or the flyovers you describe, or has the technology gotten to that point yet where it's that sensitive? Or even if we did have that technology, are we ever going to see it at the BC Wildfire Service? That I would imagine this is expensive stuff.
I mean, we utilize the satellites that are already kind of up there doing this already, and we're monitoring them all the time. So even if we did see a hot spot pop up over the winter, I wouldn't say it's out of the question, but yeah, I don't know enough about the technology to know if maybe, even if there was the heat down below, if that would be moderated by the snow above, if the cooler, if they do pop up throughout the winter, we've addressed them like we would otherwise, but I'm not 100% sure really how deep that does penetrate and how sensitive they are to the deep, deep burning.
What is that technology called?
So the one that we use is like MODIS is a really common one, and it's not just ours. There's like MODIS and VIRS, and NASA has their satellites, but there's more and more satellite technology. So actually we do have someone within the organization that this is their area of expertise.
What is your prediction currently for the fire season of 2026? You know, are we in for a big one? Is it manageable? Do we know? Is there any way of knowing what goes into that?
Yeah, again, as I mentioned, the biggest predictor of fire activity in July and August is the amount of rain that we get in May and June, typically, and even April sometimes. We are going into the season with drought. Areas of the province still in that drought, even if it's not as severe as last year, drought is certainly a factor that does play into more severe fires. Weather, however, cannot be accurately predicted beyond a couple of days out. So it's tough to say. The long-term forecast now is kind of indicating that we're going to get back to those seasonal temperatures with maybe some more rain, which is a bit of a different pattern than what we went into May experiencing. So the more rain we do get in the next couple of weeks, that'll be the biggest factor that kind of tells us what's going to happen in July and August. But there is the potential there. We already are seeing the dryness. Fuels are dry, even if it's not necessarily the drought, we're already seeing that dryness kind of go deeper as opposed to just like the top layer being quite dry. So a couple of things there, but at this point it is too early to say, but the drought is kind of the biggest factor.